Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Opening up the show with a gentleman who I have been following for a long time. His name is John Horvath. I've been reading his material for probably a couple of years now, at least it seems like at least a couple of years. I finally got him on the show. I want to ask his opinions as a gentleman with Judeo-Christian values. Number one, John, a little bit about your background, please.
Yes, it's great to be on the show.
Thank you.
I'm with an organization called Tradition Family Property. It's a civic organization of Catholic inspiration. My background is ever since my college days, I've been with this organization. So I've been with the organization 43 years, and I'm a writer, a speaker, editor, educator. I pretty much do a lot of study of our current problems, especially from a point of view of Christian morality and even Christian economics.
You know, what I'm curious about right now is one of the problems that I have with liberals, and I'm going to use the word progressive as opposed to liberal, okay? And the reason I'm using the word progressive, John, is because I'm not sure that all liberals necessarily fall into the category, or that all Democrats really fall into the category of being totally secular individuals. A lot of things are going on in our society right now that are absolutely, totally contrary to both the Old Testament and the New Testament teachings. I'd like you to opine on that a little bit, if you would, and then we'll go into some concrete examples.
Well, definitely, I think we have. We live in a decadent society. I think our culture is very much has decayed, especially since the 60s. And it has, permeated not only the liberals or the progressives, but the conservatives as well. So we're suffering from this culture that has been so overwhelming, especially for youth, to go contrary to it. And so, I think we're the political situation reflects that changing culture.
You know, but it's easy to change a political situation. It's easy for human beings if they simply follow, I would have to use the word, biblical rules. That may offend somebody, but the fact of the matter is that is absolutely true, in my opinion. I think our society has degenerated substantially because of the fact that people, as opposed to doing good things for society, seem to be very, very selfish and doing bad things. Any comment, John?
Well, definitely. I mean, we live in an individualistic society that is everyone does his own thing. It is the moral or the immoral, let's say, the immoral background of our country. The God-centered lifestyle has been so eroded, but it is really the only one that will make us happy. As much as the effort it takes to do it, it does make us happy, and this one that doesn't take nearly as much effort makes us sad.
On a more positive note, everybody is aware of the detrimental aspects of society in America right now. All you have to do is read the newspaper. And what I would like to say is, give us, if you would, John, a couple of minutes on how you think our society could become a more productive, better place.
Well, I think, as you say, I don't think everything is all gloom and doom. There are a lot of positive aspects about American life and American society. We are still, despite everything, a very religious people. I mean, when you compare us with Europe or other places that are more, that are out there, we are a very religious people. And there are a lot of people who have woken up and who have, who have been mugged by reality and who are reacting. I think the United States is one of the countries that has reacted most to the sexual revolution and to a lot of the very, very horrible trends that are dragging down society. So we do have a chance. I think we need to just keep up the fight. Otherwise, I think we need to keep up the fight.
You know, John, keeping up the fight's a really good idea. I think that the good people, and those are the people we are primarily addressing right now. I have an audience, John, that's very, very active on a blog that I associate with my radio show. And there are a number of people out there on our blog who are very, very intelligent, very intuitive, and they are unhappy with what our country is degenerated into. I think we really need to stress to folks like that what they can do to make a difference. Any ideas, John?
Well, I mean, I think that everybody has ways in which they can act in society. They can influence those around them. They can get involved in the things in their community and in their church to try to turn things around. But I, at the same time, and I, you know, I think this, as you say, there are a lot of people all over that are out there, and they need to get together. And we shouldn't exclude, we shouldn't exclude anyone, because I think there are a lot of young people out there. I know there are a lot of young people out there because I teach them, you know, that are very conservative and are very attracted by our ideals. Our ideals are very attractive, and we need to have that in mind. Yeah, that you had that in mind.
John, tell me a little bit about the young people who you work with and exactly how you work with them, would you?
Well, I teach with an institute of college-age young men, I've been very pleasantly surprised by what I've seen. You know, if you give them very if you explain things to them, if you show them that, you know, the Christian viewpoint is, you know, very is made for our nature, they are very attracted to it. And we even have programs where we go on campus and we argue about the hot button issues of the day, especially things like abortion or same-sex marriage or transgenderism. And, you know, they'll argue. And the other side really is just pretty much doesn't argue anymore. They just scream and yell and spit and burn. And, you know, they do all sorts of things. But, you know, civil discourse on the campus is really gone today, and it really shows itself when you have conservative young activists out there and who confront these issues.
John, let's talk a little bit about your views. We've got about 2 minutes left here. Talk about your views, if you would, about the importance of civil discourse. Is that something we can bring back in society, in your opinion?
It can, it is, but I mean, I think, you know, the progressive side has gone a bit beyond that, because it's not easy to do anymore. It's not the old rules don't apply. The postmodern philosophies of deconstruction and just destroying the meaning of words and ways of being has really advanced, and it's not as easy as it used to be.
No, it's not as easy as it used to be. There are a lot of reasons for that. What I would like to see is I would like to encourage listeners in the following way, John, and I know that you would agree with me on that, and I'm going to give you the final word on this. John, in 1 minute, tell me how you think we can specifically increase civil discourse.
I think we need to be very informed about the issues we're talking about. The more articulate we are about about our issues and be able to explain them in a very clear and very logical way, to that extent, we will be able to convince people. If we're not clear on our own right, we won't be able to get that discourse out there.
Simplistically, what I'm hearing you say, John, purely and simply, is don't fight anger with anger. Attempt to discourse with others explaining your point of view in a rational manner. John, you're a good guy. I'm going to get you back on the show very soon. I truly appreciate what you're doing.
Well, that's great. It's great to be on your show, and anytime.
And remember one very simple thing, guys, that I try to remember all the time. Attraction is based on example and nothing else. Stick around. More great topics coming after the break.
your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
This has everything to do with equality in America. Peter W. Sherrill. Peter is the president of Sherrill Enterprises, a publishing company that he started in the greater New York City area. He is known right now as the unknown black Republican, and he is eyeing a presidential run in the sense that he's looking at that as a write-in candidate. He is a former director of civil defense and homeland security. I got a lot of time for people like you, Peter. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Frida, you want to take over?
You're finding out about me. I'm finding out about you. But there's so much to ask you. I'm probably going to make sure you're going to come on again. So the first question here is a real alternative for America and our write-in vote campaign. Tell us about that. Tell us about your 2020 write-in presidential candidate. What is that and what are you doing for that?
Well, really started after I realized that Donald Trump had a significant stronghold over the Republican Party, and there was no way to even break that stronghold. As you know, or may not know, you know, I was a Democrat for almost 40 years before I guess I said enough is enough. And then I left and I joined the Republican Party in 2011. And some reason, the Republican Party just seemed to fit me where I was at that point in time in my life. I was just turning a little over 50. I think your morals and your values shift, and I could no longer align myself with the Democratic Party. So I had such hope for things in the Republican Party until 2016 happened. So my campaign for 2020, I decided to launch the write-in vote campaign because, you know, there is just something fundamentally sacred about the write-in vote. It was given to us by the founding fathers of this nation. And it was like, well, why did they give this caveat? Or some people say like a silver bullet. And I came to the conclusion that they knew then that there would come a point in time in this country where our elections would become so convoluted and so corrupt with all kind of corporate money and all kind of foreign governments interfering and bringing their money and controlling our electorate. The right and vote gives the power to the people to have the final say at the end of the day in the election process. And so that's the grounds that I pursue the write and vote campaign upon.
You know, I just want to say one thing, Mr. Sherrill, real quickly here, and that is that you are a perfect example of the type of individual who Frida and I are highlighting on the show now. I know we're talking a little bit about politics. I applaud you, number one, Mr. Sherrill, for the fact that you look at the moral values that are espoused right now by the Democratic Party. And I applaud you for turning away from it back in 2011, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, there was just no way I could continue. You know, I guess as Dr. Fernbaum can attest to this, you know, things change when you, that 50 age, that 60, and now that I'm plus 60, it's just hard to really align yourself with something that goes against your moral, everything that you believe morally. It's just like, there's no way I could not just blindly align myself with that any longer. Blind loyalty is deadly and dangerous on either side of the aisle.
Well, what's good about this conversation that we're having, you know, it wakes people up to think for themselves. And as you're saying, to have these alternative ways of looking at our country today. And you've done so much. You're also a former director in the civil defense and homeland security. And you've worked 25 years in corporate America. So first I'd like to ask you, what was it that you did in corporate America that made a difference?
That's a great question, Frida. You know, my life in corporate America was really a battle from the time that I graduated with my bachelor's in management and economics and minored in psychology and sociology. That was in 1980. And there just weren't any job opportunities for me. So it was this battle, and then there was this backlash against affirmative action in this country. See, there's always these backlashes. And so I found myself just starting out at a retail position with a four-year degree, almost similar to what people are finding out that they experience in a day. Deals a lot with it. But, you know, I ended up at Texaco, and then I ended up and racial discrimination lawsuit, and it was pretty brutal. You know, the tensions were mounting, and it was an actual all-out war in corporate America. Although Texaco was I worked at the corporate headquarters. It was great. I started there delivering boxes as a temp. They created a position for me. But when it came time to deal with me as a graduate with a Bachelor of Science in Management and Economics, they didn't know what to do with me or where to place me. And so, you know, my life in corporate America was a long, hard struggle. But I still love that environment.
But you kept struggling. You've kept struggling from there on to becoming a former director of civil defense and homeland security. So you kept moving on in a direction where you felt that there was a cause. What was your life like then? What was your purpose? And what were your accomplishments at that time?
Well, it's kind of as I went into government, and it's ironic because I really became reunited with the mayor of Mount Vernon, you know, the city that I was born and raised in, at various functions that I would attend at Texaco because they were trying to change their image. And so after I left from Texaco, I kind of connected with the mayor, and this position came available. But one of the things that I will say about after the lawsuit was over, Texaco did try to find out where I would excel. They should have did that maybe 10 or 12 years earlier, but they did, and that's when they put me in community relations. And so from the community relations, I got involved with the different non-for-profits, Boys and Girls Club, and doing things in the community. And so it was because of that I found my niche. And let me tell you, when I became that director of civil defense, homeland security, it was like the blossoming of a rose in full bloom. Everything just was perfect. It was like I found something that I love to do because you really help people, and you were dealing with the security of not only your city but your country. And I had the opportunity to train all over this country.
Okay.
Respond throughout this nation.
Peter, unfortunately, we have to cut it here. We're going to take a real quick commercial break. I want to say you are, number one, the kind of person who we want to have on the program because you are a great example of somebody who does not listen to society and just forges ahead, making America a better place. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Sherrill, we should all emulate you in our lives as being a positive example.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in time for the second half of KER Politics. Going to start off with Dr. John Huber. You know, John, the COVID-19 virus is a very serious virus, but there are a number of positive things societally that have happened as a result of that. Can you talk about that a little bit? Maybe let's start out with improvements in family life.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's probably one of the most important things. You know, families are reconnecting. Parents are learning how to get back in touch and communicate with their kids. Kids are learning how to communicate with adults. You know, this generation that's stuck at home now doing middle school, elementary school, and high school, they've only known a world full of screens and screen presence, and their friends are online. And they've lost a lot of social skills. Now the parents are home, the kids are home together. and they're having lunch together. They're getting up and having breakfast and having discussion before their classes start, before the parents go working online. And they're having dinner together because everybody's there. It's actually bringing a lot of families together. I mean, we can talk, like we've talked off the air, about how all these difficult things are going on. But the reality of it is, nothing worthwhile is easy. And so parents have had to kind of sharpen their communication skills and get back in touch with these kids, and they're benefiting from it. The families are benefiting from it. Even the infants are benefiting from it. We've got a significant drop in sudden infant death syndrome. And why? I think it's because parents have slowed down a little bit, and they're spending extra time with their kids, their infants, even more so than they normally would. They're much more connected with them. And I think the infants are responding very positively to it. And we've had that drop. I think that's really one of the most important things that is keeping those numbers low. And it's an awesome, positive, upbeat thing we need to be aware of.
You know, one comment I would have to make about COVID is that it is putting a certain amount of discipline into people's lives. The real problem with COVID, mortality is an issue, but I don't believe that the stats are in yet definitively to show that all of society is affected by that. I mean, people in a high-risk category, such as myself and my wife, certainly have to be very, very careful. And we are very careful, and that's putting a certain amount of self-discipline into our lives. In terms of what's going on with the school kids, I've heard a lot of negative things from various physicians who I talk with, from my acupuncturist, interestingly enough, who really questioned the validity of schools being closed right now, given the mortality rates of that particular demographic if they happen to get COVID. Johnny, what's your...
Well, I think they're right in a lot of ways, but right now, you know, the jury's still out. We don't have all the data in, and what we do get is so muddled with so many different biases, whether it's political or scientific, or this research institute is being funded by this drug company, so the data needs to look good for that, you know, antibiotic or that vaccine or whatever. And really, you know, I've had this discussion with my peers, the doctors of the hospital. We probably really won't know true definitively for about 3 years. And that's about how long it's going to take for the 200 countries that have been affected, well, actually, it's like, what, 180, 179 countries that have been affected by this significantly, for all their universities to get their researches done and have it go through peer-reviewed articles or journals and have the scientific community review things. And we're going to start seeing the same sorts of data being repeated all around the country, all around the world. And that's going to give us what's really going on. And it's going to take about 3 years for that to happen. You know, the research has already started, but I think we as a community, a world community, we're going to have to really struggle through with this, find out what works, do the best we can. You know, again, some of the positive things, you know, it's 99% of the population, it's not going to affect them as far as lethality is concerned. It's that less than 1% that we have to worry about it. And, you know, people over 55, the numbers start going up. Over 70, it's really significant. But below that, the younger populations, you know, they are reacting really well to this. And the positive thing I see is that, yeah, we may not have a good vaccine for it, but as the younger population gets more and more exposed to it and they survive it, they're creating kind of this herd immunity to this, and it will benefit our society and culture in time. Right now, we're struggling with it.
Well, what the whole thing boils down to, in my opinion, is purely and simply, rather than going into all of the research and rather going into the what if, ands and buts, etc., I think it's very simple. You have to use common sense. If you are in a high-risk category, I think you simply have to self-quarantine, and there's really no choice about that. I think the positives, I don't want to say that the positives necessarily outweigh the negative, because there are people dying from this on a daily basis, but I want to say I think it's important to concentrate for people in my demographic on common sense, as it is to concentrate on common sense regarding all things of the human life. I think at this point in time, we have to just be thankful that if you're under the age of 60, you're probably going to be okay. If your kids should go to school, if the businesses should stay closed, that's an entirely different issue. I personally believe that, right. but for people who are self-quarantining, who need to self-quarantine, they need to stay out of that universe, and it's no more complicated than that, is it, John?
I think you're right, but I think there's other benefits to what we're learning right now. I think the behaviors of being diligent about washing your hands, instead of just dropping your hands under the water and grabbing a paper towel and walking out, actually rubbing and using soap and things like that, I think we're going to see a decrease in the amount of common colds, the decrease in the flu. I think a lot of traditional diseases that we just kind of take for granted, which all of them, when you're debilitated, you know, you start having to deal with these on a lethal level, all of those diseases, whether it's the cold or the flu. And I think what we're learning and what society is dealing with now is going to make us a safer, healthier population in the long run. And so that's another positive thing that I think we're getting out of this.
Johnny, let me ask you this. I think another positive thing is self-reliance and common sense. How do you feel about mandated vaccinations? Once a vaccine is available, do you think people should be able just simply to say, I'm making up my own mind? What's your opinion, Johnny?
I think I have privileges at two hospitals, which is medical hospitals, which is kind of unusual for a psychologist. And, you know, I go in and walk through the steps with people who are refusing medical treatment. And in our country, we've always had the ability as individuals to refuse certain medical treatment and to deal with the consequences as an individual. And sometimes these consequences are death for my patients. And I get asked by the administrative staff, the physicians, go in and talk to these people and make sure they fully understand the consequences of refusing treatment. And so many patients really do. You know, that they understand that the potential for side effects for different medications or going on this life support machine means that they're going to be in that hospital room, you know, for the rest of their lives, whether they live 2 weeks or 20 years longer than this, they're going to be stuck in that hospital room. And they choose not to live a life like that. And I think we should continue that. I mean, it is a choice as a human being, whether I'm going to take an antibiotic or not. And that should be given to everybody, and forcing somebody to take that. You know, when we're talking about, for example, meningitis, okay? Meningitis, most colleges, most schools say, if you're going to come to our school, you have to the severity of the disease. I think Americans, you know, well, that's part of our freedom. Freedom's not free, and I believe we should have the choice to choose not to take the vaccine or to take it. And as young as that vaccine is, as new as it is, there's so much potential for harm. I'm choosing not to take it.
Hey, John, as you just said, it is a personal choice as long as you don't harm other people. Hey, welcome in here to wrap up KER Politics, final segment, 9 minutes and 50 seconds, almost 10 minutes. I'm talking with Dr. Charles Page. Charles is the author of the book that we are offering to anybody who wants it. It's entitled A Spoonful of Courage for the Sick and Suffering, Transforming Your Greatest Challenges into Your Biggest Blessings. I read the book cover to cover, and I have to tell you, there are some fascinating stories in there coming from Dr. Page. Doc, what I want to talk about first is I want to talk about mandated vaccinations. That's a subject that is near and dear to the hearts of an awful lot of very active bloggers. How do you feel about that, sir?
Well, I'm not excited about any kind of mandated things where people push their agendas on us. I think we have to look back at several different, you know, kind of root issues before we make a good informed decision about whether or not we're going to take a vaccine or not. So, first of all, we need to realize kind of where we came from. I mean, there's, you know, the old saying, we have a saying in Texas, don't take down a fence post until it was put up, until we know why it was put up in the first place.
Right.
And so that fence post was there, Al, because, you know, people were dying of all kinds of things. For example, the DPT vaccine, diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus. I mean, if you've ever seen anybody die from tetanus, and I've seen some cases of diphtheria when I've worked in hospitals on, you know, in the third world. I mean, those are bad diseases. And so, you know, there's a benefit to those vaccines. For example, MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella. I mean, if you've ever seen, I remember when I was in college, I went and worked down in Mexico, and there was an outbreak of measles, or sarampión, as they say. And,
Yep. Man,
seeing kids die of measles, I mean, it really kind of wakes you up to the reality of the benefit of vaccines. So that's one of the reasons why that fence post was put up. Think about the polio vaccine. I mean, a couple of years ago, I was in Africa and I saw a young man who developed polio. And, you know, so if we think about those things, there's a reason why that fence post is up there. But here's the big controversy. A lot of the things, a lot of the additives that they're putting into these vaccines are dangerous, especially for kids. There's this substance called thimerosal, which is kind of it has a specific type of mercury in it. And there's some people that maintain that this thimerosal causes Tourette's syndrome, ADD, all kinds of neurologic problems, and specifically autism and SIDS and all these things. And, you know, there's been studies both ways, you know, that show that there's no reputable studies, is what the CDC says, but there's other people that say, hey, wait a minute, they've done tracings of this, and there's like, one part per million in each one of these vaccines, and over time that accumulates, and it's even higher in each one of these doses than what the EPA recommends for people. So there's some real issues here, and there's a lot of people saying, hey, we're giving our kids these vaccines, and I mean, they're getting autism, they're getting Tourette's, they're getting ADD, and a lot of these other neurological problems are from the fact of the vaccines and what we're doing to people. And so, you know, we kind of have to take all that into view before we make a good decision. You know, we think about, right now, the big thing right now is the coronavirus vaccine, you know, the COVID vaccine. And, you know, we have both political parties saying, well, you know, Trump's touting this is going to be great. And then, of course, you know, the other side and Biden are saying, well, man, this is terrible because Trump invented it. But, I think it's going to be a different issue. I mean, we're not going to be giving the vaccine to young people who would have these things. This would be something we're going to be giving to more senior people and people at risk. So I don't think there's going to be the risk there. And that's what everybody, I think, needs to think about, you know, before we, you know, even with the government. You know, the government loves to mandate things and try to do kind of this broad stroke when we're individuals and we each need to make our own good informed decisions. So I don't really want to kind of beat people over the head and say, well, government shouldn't be mandating, because there's a reason why that fence post is there. But on the other hand, I think we need to take a step back and look at the risk and benefits for everybody. And so probably, I think for my kids, they've all had all of their shots. None of my kids are going to go to Harvard, you know, but they don't have a neurologic disorder, you know. So we've been fine. But I think you have to look at those things, and you have to realize that a lot of times to be able to go to public schools, you have to have those vaccines. And so if you're going to make that decision, and you can make that decision, you have to understand the consequences of that, is you may have to homeschool your kids. And
yeah.
So those are all things you've got to think about before you make those decisions.
Chuck, I think that's a very good point. I'm going to ask you one other question real quick here. We've got about, got about 4 minutes left here, a little bit less than that, but I've got a very active member of our audience. His name is Larry. He's a retired dentist. very much of a naturopathic fan. Actually, the guy talked me into doing some acupuncture for muscular issues that I have. And those that acupuncture seems to be working pretty good. Talk a little bit, in your opinion, about naturopathic medicine and conventional medicine, would you?
Well, that's a great question, Al. So, you know, once again, I went through kind of the classical medical training, you know, and once again, during that training, you know, there's that saying, when all you have is a hammer, all the world's a nail, you know?
Yeah.
And so often, you know, I think in medicine, we, if we don't, you know, we try to hit every nail with the hammer that we have. And there are a lot of diseases that we just can't explain in medicine. And one thing I've realized over the past 20 years or so is that, you know, sometimes we don't have all the answers in medicine. You know, sometimes there are diseases and entities that we really haven't understood very well yet. And so, you know, I don't think that, you know, that medicine has all of the answers. You know, one of the interesting things I've kind of learned over the years is that, you know, the medicine that at least we learned in medical school was really kind of just fixing the symptoms to the problem and not really taking, you know, a look at the underlying root causes of why this happened in the first place. And I think that's one of the things where naturopathic and homeopathic medicine or functional medicine comes in, is that, you know, these people look at not just the symptoms and not just how to put the Band-Aid on the problem, but really look at the root causes. And so, you know, there's a whole new field of medicine that's opening up in this area. So, you know, I think, though, too, we need to realize that there's a lot of charlatans out there that they're going to try to sell you some snake oil and tell you that this is going to fix all your problems and charge you a bunch of money for some things that are not really going to work and have not really been proven. I mean, they may make intellectual sense, but there's no studies that show that. So I think you kind of have to go in with an open mind. You also kind of have to go in a little skeptical. But, you know, I think you need to be a little skeptical of the medicine that I practice, too. I mean, you know, everything that we do in medicine has risk and benefits. And so you have to go in with an open mind. And I think the thing I would encourage folks is to really try to become your own healthcare advocate and learn in the process.
You know, Dr. Page, I got to tell you, I appreciate everything that you're saying. I happen to agree with both the topics, your opinion on both of these topics right now. Again, I want to offer your book, A Spoonful of Courage for the Sick and Suffering, Transforming Your Greatest Challenges into Your Biggest Blessings. You let me know if you want that book. You let me know where to send it. My nickel, I will do it. As I said, I've read the book cover to cover. There are some absolutely miraculous stories in there. I also want to stress one other thing. Dr. Page will be on the show on a weekly basis. Any questions that you might have for him, not necessarily going to address them in daily editorials unless there is a plethora of those questions. I guess I should use the word are, a plethora of those questions. But we will address them either in daily editorials, I promise, or we will address them on the weekend radio show. Dr. Charles W. Page, you're a good guy. Thank you so much, sir.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.